Welcome to episode 37 of Bills with Luke Scorzel. The world is full of conflict, but no region is as turbulent as the Middle East. From the Israeli-Palestinian disputes, to the civil war in Syria, to the rise and fall of the Islamic State, and even more conflict in Yemen, the region is full of violence and aggression. And these conflicts come with a litany of human rights violations and abuses. Organizations like Human Rights Watch work fervently to protect the rights of people living in this region. And today, the executive director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa division joins us on the show. We sit down for an in-depth conversation on her work right after this. Now, before we get into the interview, I'd first like to take a minute to thank some of our patrons. First, thank you to Zach for his amazing $30 donation. Greatly appreciated. That's $30 a month. So for that, he's actually going to be able to participate in our next interview with Brian Nichols, and he's actually going to submit some questions. So if you'd like to do that, you can head on over to patreon.com/billsluke and become a patron today and get to participate in some of the interviews with our guests. Also, thank you to Mike, Julie, and Tiana for their amazing $15 a month donations. Greatly appreciated. And thank you to all of our other lower level patrons. You guys are appreciated as well. You can go on over to patreon.com/billsluke and become a patron today and reap the rewards and the gifts. We have great stickers, some good benefits coming up, including possibly live shows. So head on over right now. And without further ado, let's get into the interview. Today, we're here with Sarah Lee Whitson of the Human Rights Watch. Now, she has a very extensive background in human rights, especially in the Middle East. So to begin, she graduated from UC Berkeley and then went on to pursue a Juris Doctor degree from Harvard Law School. After graduating from Harvard, she worked for Goldman Sachs and was an attorney at Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton. During this same time, she was volunteering for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, where she would go on to serve 2 terms on the board of directors of the New York chapter. Additionally, she worked as the general counsel for the Center for Economic and Social Rights, where she was very involved with work in Iraq. And now she joins us on the show today. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
So obviously you have a massive background in human rights and the legal field, but now and for the last more than a decade, you've been working for the Human Rights Watch, which was a pretty big move, right?
I guess it was a pretty big move 14 years ago. In terms of, you know, this human rights work actually being my occupation, in addition to something that I spent time personally doing, it sort of became my job and my career, from which I actually also receive income. Mm-hmm.
And then as the executive director, what is some of the work that you do? You oversee the Middle East and the North African region, which, as we know, is one of the most turbulent regions in the world, especially concerning your work. So how do you manage it all?
We have a team of about 35 people covering 19 countries in the Middle East and North Africa. We've most recently added Mauritania coverage to our portfolio, about which we're very happy because it's something we've long wanted to do. We have a team of researchers, fluctuates between 10 and 11 researchers covering the 19 countries. And I have 3 deputy directors who work with me to oversee the researchers, as well as many research assistants that support the researchers, administrative staff, translation staff, social media staff, all of whom work as part of the MENA division to investigate human rights abuses in the region and expose them through the news and direct advocacy, as well as trying to push for change. So what I'm primarily involved in is overseeing the strategy and the approach for all of our work throughout the region. Although we're a very bottom-up driven organization, that our country researchers play the leading role in determining what we're going to be working on in any particular year. So we have a very rigorous annual planning process where our researchers identify their work priorities and their plans for the coming year. We review that and discuss that and tweak that. And then I, you know, just oversee us getting from point A to point B so that all of our researchers are able to carry out the work that they've set out to do. They work in collaboration with our advocacy division and our communications division to get the message out and to determine our advocacy strategies on particular issues. In addition, I'm often involved in direct advocacy with governments or armed groups related to the work that we're doing. So I travel a great deal in relation to that, and I'm also spending a lot of time raising money for our work because somebody's got to pay for the work that Human Rights Watch is doing. And fortunately, we have a lot of supporters, private individuals and foundations that stand behind our work, and I try to connect with them as often as I can.
So obviously a lot of great work that you're doing. So getting more into the substance of what it is that especially you are doing for the Human Rights Watch, if we look to the West Bank, there have been a lot of protests over the last few months, and especially after President Trump announced that the United States was actually going to move Israel's capital to Jerusalem. How has this move then, for better or worse, changed the human rights situation in the West Bank? And as we were talking before the show, there's just been an announcement, or it's gotten out, that the U.S. is actually looking to withdraw from the United Nations Human Rights Council. And a lot of that is stemmed from its criticisms of Israel and this move itself.
Well, with respect to the move of the American embassy to Jerusalem, that's not directly a human rights issue or even an international humanitarian law issue, because the embassy is placed in Western Jerusalem, which is part of the recognized landmass of the State of Israel, and so it's not on occupied territory per se. But of course, it has always historically been one of the key negotiating points about the status of Jerusalem as a unified city, East and West Jerusalem. And to the extent that it has, I think, exposed and revealed the fact that there is no peace process, that there are unilateral moves that jump to conclusions on matters that are supposed to be subject of negotiations, I certainly don't think it's a good move for resolving the conflict in an equitable and just manner. But it's also been a good move because I think it has revealed what everybody has known for a very long time, which is that the United States is not a neutral arbiter of conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, but that in fact it's quite partisan and one-sided, and that is, of course, on the side of Israel, in addition to the tens of billions of dollars in aid that it has given and continues to give Israel for its military, which is the reason why Israel is the military power that it is and enables it to continue the land confiscations of Palestinian territory throughout the West Bank. And so forth, the move on this key negotiating point, the unilateral move by the United States, is also a further show of the hand of where the United States stands on this matter. So it has an odd way of ripping off the mask and the illusion that many, I think, have relied on to avoid dealing with the reality of the issues facing them. There is no peace process. There is continued land confiscation and land theft of Palestinian lands, including forced displacement of the population there, including entrenched racial, religious, and ethnic discrimination against the population there. And there is no panacea of two-state solution that's going to solve that just around the horizon. And so by exposing that reality, I think it will, I hope, nudge the international community to now determine what it's going to do with this unlawful situation of continued exploitation and abuse of the rights of Palestinians with no end in sight.
So then, as the Human Rights Watch, what do you see as the best move moving forward from this, since now we know that the United States is siding with one side, and whether or not that's good or bad, what do you see as the move that maybe the international community should take as a result of this?
I think from a human rights organization's perspective, we're really not interested per se in what state configuration the peoples of the region choose, whether it's one state or two states or five states or a confederation or a bilateral arrangement like the EU, whatever political arrangement wants to be achieved is really up to the political parties to decide. What is not negotiable, however, is the human rights of people who are living under Israeli authority. And so what we advocate is that people under Israeli authority should have their human rights respected. And given the obvious permanence of the military occupation, given the fact that it's been 50 years that Palestinians are living under military occupation, we now have to focus on what is just and equitable, given what is essentially a permanent state of being, and that has to be equality under the law for all of the people under Israeli authority, Palestinian and Israeli, an end to discrimination and restrictions on Palestinians that is unique to them as Palestinian Muslims and Christians, so that they have the same status and legal protections and rights and access to justice as Israeli Jewish citizens living under Israeli jurisdiction. So what I think is the principled approach to this, and where it's important for all of us to at least agree on first principles, is that there should be equality for everyone under Israel's permanent occupation. There should be justice, and there should be human rights. So these are pretty basic principles, but they've lived under the shadow and murkiness and confusion that a state of military occupation otherwise creates. Under international law, a military occupation is supposed to be temporary. So there should be a temporary suspension of rights under emergency measures that are warlike measures. But in a state of permanent occupation with no end in sight, we have to revert to maximizing human rights protections, equality, and justice for all.
So then what, who or where exactly, I guess, is the military occupation? Is that just the Israeli state or just along the region occupied by the Palestinians? Where exactly are you talking about?
So the military occupation is Israel's military occupation of the occupied Palestinian territories. Mm-hmm. This is what numerous UN resolutions talk about and call for an end to, which is the military occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and Gaza. These are the lands that remain under direct or de facto occupation by Israel. So that is what we're talking about when we're talking about a military occupation. The Palestinians don't militarily occupy anything. Military occupation is a term of international law.
So then moving forward from that, what I guess the move has caused in terms of a lot of human rights violations have been organized protests along the Israel-Gaza border that have actually resulted in the deaths of over 120 Palestinians and over 3,800 more being wounded by gunfire from the Israeli army. So what is your perspective on these events and who exactly is responsible? Because a lot of the protests were actually organized by Hamas in the region.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things. First of all, the protests were not solely or exclusively or even predominantly related to the move of the American embassy to Jerusalem. The protests were to commemorate the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians from their lands in 1948 and onwards, and in recognition of the reality that a very large part of Gaza's population, I think perhaps even the majority, I'm not quite sure about the number, of the 2 million people who live in Gaza today are in fact refugees from lands that are now today part of the Israeli state. And so the primary call of the protest was to commemorate their expulsion from their lands in 1948 to Gaza, where they live as refugees. Beyond that, the protests were highlighting the fact that for over 10 years now, 12 years in fact, Gaza has lived under an extreme policy of closure by Israel, with its land and sea borders nearly airtight, allowing no exports, virtually no exports of Gaza's manufacturing goods, not allowing people to leave and enter freely, really just strangulating the people of Gaza with very limited supplies of water and electricity, complete collapse of their economy, all in response to the fact that in the 2006 elections that were held in the Palestinian territories, Hamas's political wing won the elections in Gaza and became the authorized government there. With respect to the protests themselves, in fact, the protests were organized mostly via Facebook by civil society organizations, of which there are dozens, if not hundreds, in Gaza. As I was just describing, the purposes and the calls of the protests and the reason they were organized, primarily and overwhelmingly to demonstrate against their continued collective punishment by the Israeli authorities, their strangulation, their complete cutoff from the world in a way that has extremely inhumane and cruel consequences on the people of Gaza, students who can't leave to study, patients who can't obtain medical care, businesses, economies that can't function because they can't export or freely import, and so forth. That Hamas, whether it's political wing that is the political authority in Gaza, or even in its armed faction, Islamic Jihad, may have encouraged or supported the protests is absolutely irrelevant. There is no prohibition or restriction on an armed group even calling for protests. That's perfectly within their prerogative to do. And so I'm not quite sure what the relevance of this is, other than the persistent evocation of the boogeyman of Hamas as some kind of boogeyman organization and sort of a refusal to recognize that Hamas is a multi-pronged organization that operates as the government in Gaza, that administers schools in Gaza, that operates the courts in Gaza, that operates the traffic and sanitation in Gaza, as well as having an armed group that participates or has participated in military actions against Israel.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that they were peaceful protests, you're saying, it doesn't matter who organized them. The problem is that the Israeli army actually took action against these protests.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I would say it's completely irrelevant of who organized them, supported them, encouraged them, and so forth. When you look at the protests themselves, and when we assess Israel's conduct with respect to the protests, what our research and investigation has found, and I should say as mirrored by the research and investigations of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, as well as Amnesty International and various other international and local human rights organizations, is that Israel used excessive force, excessive violence, particularly in using live ammunition to target and kill overwhelmingly peaceful protesters, including medics, doctors, nurses, who were arriving at the protests to care for those who were wounded and injured.
So then, as a result of these protests, the United Nations actually passed a resolution that blamed Israel for the violence in Gaza. I guess we've already a little bit briefed over this, but the United States had actually asked that a condemnation of Hamas be added. Should Hamas have been added to the resolution? I guess maybe not, since they were organizing what your organization is saying to be peaceful protests.
I think that they were actually mentioned in the General Assembly resolution that was ultimately passed. I think that the difference is that the U.S. put forward a draft resolution that omitted any condemnation of Israel's conduct, including the shocking killing of 120 protesters who posed no threat to Israel or Israelis. They were hundreds of meters away from Israel, in addition to, you know, unbelievable number, 3,800 people being wounded. I should say many, many, many of them shot deliberately in the kneecap, above the thigh, with very high projectile fragmentation bullets that, according to medics and doctors and Medicine Sans Frontières, who've been treating patients on the wound, are causing a permanent paralysis to many, many hundreds of the youth who were injured. So these are deliberate bullets at their legs and their knees with very high caliber weapons.
Obviously a massive conflict there, and one that the Human Rights Watch will keep a close watch on, I'm sure. But one of the other most dangerous conflicts in the Middle East is actually occurring in Yemen. So the United Nations recently referred to Yemen as having the world's worst and largest humanitarian crisis. Can you give us kind of an overview of what exactly is happening? I don't really believe that it's that well covered in the United States.
So there has been a war going on in Yemen for over 3 years now, and the war has involved a widespread indiscriminate bombardment by Saudi Arabia, ostensibly as part of the Saudi-led coalition of major capitals in Yemen that are under the control of the Houthi government. The Houthis are a small portion of the population who overtook the country in a military coup, allied with the former government of Yemen that had been overthrown, the Saleh government that had been in power for many decades. In addition to the indiscriminate bombardment, Saudi Arabia has closed off and taken control over all ports and passages of entry into Yemen, severely limiting the ability of the country to import needed foods and medicines, because Yemen, in fact, imports 90% of its food and virtually all of its medicine. It is this that has caused a severe humanitarian crisis in the country, with epidemic levels of cholera and other waterborne diseases, an extremely dire situation, massive food insecurity, including malnutrition, starvation that has been documented because of the closure, the effective closure of the entire country of Yemen, which has about 25 million people. Most recently, what the Saudis and the Emiratis, who are the lead players in this coalition, declared that they wanted to attack Hodeidah, the port of Hodeidah, which is the largest port in the country, where almost all of the food and medicines and supplies come into the country, albeit under very close UN scrutiny. The Saudis and Emiratis want to take over Hodeidah because it is under the control of the Houthi government. Yet that military attack on port basically renders the port inaccessible. No ships are going to be able to come in and out. And so it risks dramatically worsening an already very dire humanitarian situation.
And so what exactly can be done to stop those governments from attacking that port? And if they do end up attacking it and essentially destroying it, what is the solution for all the civilians that remain in the city?
Well, the attack is actually underway. They've actually also sent in some ground troops, so expect there to be an escalation of fighting on the ground. Unfortunately, there is little that can be done to protect the civilians who are paying the cost for this mindless war, because the United States basically gave Saudi Arabia and the UAE the green light to proceed with this rather reckless and scary invasion of Hodeidah port.
So the United States has actually gotten involved in this conflict. Is it in a very significant manner, and under which administrations?
So the U.S. has been involved in the war in Yemen from the get-go, starting under the Obama administration. The U.S., under the Obama administration, agreed to support Saudi Arabia and the UAE in what they foolishly promised or considered to be a war that would last a couple of months to get rid of the Houthi-backed government. In fact, as we now see, the war has dragged on for several years, and the Houthi government is not any weaker or showing any signs of collapse, certainly. The U.S. Has, of course, provided the, is the main military supplier to both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The Saudi Arabia is the number one weapons client of the United States, most recently inking a $100 billion deal with the Trump administration for more weapons. In addition to these weapon sales, the United States is directly a party to the conflict and, in fact, has expanded its military role in this conflict by providing the Saudi Emirati fighting forces with what's called targeting assistance. So actually providing them with assistance in identifying targets. And given the wildly indiscriminate bombardment that's happened, one must wonder just what kind of targeting assistance they've actually given them since it's turned out so very badly. They are also helping them and refueling the planes, the Saudi weaponry, which makes them, again, also a direct party to this conflict.
And is the Houthi government, do they have human rights violations that are worth this war, or would it be better to just leave this alone? Or what is your perspective on the war as a whole?
Well, I mean, the Saudi Emirati / Saudi coalition war against Yemen has nothing to do with human rights in Yemen. It is solely and exclusively limited to the fact that the Houthis overtook the government in Yemen, and the Houthis are not a party that are 100% under Saudi Arabian and Emirati control. At the time, at the beginning of the war, they said that it was a preemptive war to prevent Iran from forming a relationship with the Houthis, in effect giving them more control and leverage over Yemen. That may well happen now because of what the Saudis and Emiratis have done, in effect forcing the Houthis to find an ally. And certainly the Houthis and Iran have developed a closer diplomatic relationship. There have been extensive allegations of Iran providing military weapons to the Houthis, but very little by way of evidence, despite repeated numerous investigations and studies. And as I was mentioning earlier, the fact that the sea and land borders are virtually sealed off of Yemen, so very little, next to nothing, comes in without Saudi scrutiny and Emirati scrutiny. But certainly the Houthis have been responsible for severe abuses of their own, including indiscriminate shelling and bombardment of areas in as part of their military conflict with the Saudis and the Emiratis, and the so-called legitimate government of Yemen under President Hadi that was overthrown by the Houthis. They have extensively used landmines in their conflict, prohibited weapons under international treaties. They have arbitrarily detained hundreds of Yemenis, including journalists and activists. And there's also been quite a bit of documentation of the Houthis using child soldiers, which is something that we have documented repeatedly.
And so the war and the side of Saudi Arabia and UAE, they really don't care at all about any of these human rights violations, and they're just more concerned about the imperial aspects of this war?
Yeah, I mean, they have never once claimed that human rights in Yemen is anywhere near on their radar screen. And it would be laughable even if it were, because I would suggest that they start with the human rights violations in their own countries before they try to make something in another country.
Could a possible byproduct of the war be an improvement in the human rights situation in Yemen, or?
No, this is the greatest disaster to befall Yemen in modern history.
Well, on the other side of the world, North Korea just had a summit with the United States, and not quite related to the Middle East, but in the way that North Korea has an atrocious human rights record, and there are many countries in the Middle East who would probably love to negotiate with the United States, I guess in that way it does. So first, what are your thoughts on the Trump-Kim summit?
Well, I hesitate to venture into giving my opinions on this because it's actually not my area of expertise. It's covered extensively by our Asia division that has provided, you know, really very detailed commentary on the Trump-Kim summit, as well as the need to highlight human rights and the deplorable, unbelievable, shocking human rights conditions inside North Korea as part of the discussions. I don't know if I should really call them negotiations because I don't think they actually negotiated very much. But I really would not want to comment further on that given it's not my area of expertise.
Yeah. So maybe back related a little bit with the Middle East, does that have any implications for governments in the Middle East who would like to negotiate or discuss either one with the United States?
I doubt it. In fact, it shows, ironically, the unbelievable double standards and hypocrisy of the Trump administration in their willingness to absolve North Korea of any responsibility for its ongoing nuclear testing and nuclear development, and to just, you know, announce that they are now denuclearized because they promised so when this extensive regime put in place of inspections and monitoring in Iran as part of the agreement to ensure that they don't develop nuclear weapons capabilities and so forth, the U.S. has just walked away from. So something with actual teeth and accountability and control in an agreement rigorously developed in a multilateral agreement representing, you know, many, many states is abandoned willy-nilly while we take promises at face value from an authoritarian dictatorial leader who's been treasonous to his closest family members, not even counting what he's done to his population, without any agreement, without any inspections, without any monitoring. So unfortunately, I think it highlights the extent to which there is arbitrariness, double standards, you know, just impulsiveness in the Trump administration's approach to these very important issues.
Yeah, and we've certainly heard from North Korea that they would denuclearize before, and that's obviously never happened. And they continue to pursue nuclear weapons. So moving on back to the Middle East. Originally, I saw you give a speech at Claremont McKenna College. And one of the topics that was brought up, I believe, in the Q&A was identity politics and some of the situations in the Middle East and in your own life that have included that. And you had some thoughts, I believe. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that and your experiences with it?
You know, I guess I would say, and I would be quoting a very close friend of mine who's a surgeon in Lebanon, is that identity politics really don't interest me in the way that a politics of ideology interests me. Politics of ideology is one that can bring people together on the basis of ideals and principles and strategy. Identity politics ultimately is something that divides us on the basis of physical differences that I guess are insurmountable since we're born into them, and don't really unite us around politics and strategy and principles. And I guess I've seen firsthand the dangers and the consequences of identity politics taken to their max. And that is many, many of the disputes in the Middle East today are fundamentally identity politics and perceived suffering of various religious, ethnic, racial communities in the Middle East, whether it's the Sunni-Shia split, whether it's the Muslim-Christian split, whether it's the Sahrawi-Moroccan split, whether, you know, I can go on the lists of identity divisions that are effectively destroying the region right now. And I think it would be a much more effective tool to identify the principles around which we want to unite and the strategy for coming up with plans to effectuate those principles in a way that I think will make us all stronger, more cohesive and more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. And so then moving back, and I remember maybe you said you didn't have the purview maybe to discuss identity politics in the United States, but what can people in the United States learn from the role that identity politics has played in the Middle East and the conflicts that it has caused?
Well, I mean, I just, again, I think if you see the divisions and the conflict and the discord that identity politics has brought to the Middle East, it can be a warning sign of what the consequences of an exclusive identity-focused politics can lead to. And I hope people take that very seriously. And again, you know, focus on what will bring people together as opposed to what will keep people apart.
Definitely. I totally agree with that. And so moving towards the end, I guess the final question may be one that people have been pondering for a very long time, but is there a foreseeable time of peace in the Middle East?
Well, you know, I mean, I would say obviously I hope so, but I don't see that in the near term and even in the medium term. Part of the problem with the Middle East now is that the conflicts are not for the people of any state to solve. So the Egyptian revolution and the Egyptian experiment with democracy wasn't really up to the people of Egypt and the government of Egypt to negotiate and work out and figure out and so forth. But it became a project of intervention for powers in the region, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who decided they didn't want to see democracy flourish in Egypt and so supported the military coup that overthrew the democratically elected leadership. Similarly, in Syria, it wasn't up to the people of Syria nor the Syrian government to decide how they wanted to reconfigure their state in a way that would be more just. It became an exercise of regional and global political competition with motivations and strategies that had nothing to do with rights and freedoms of the Syrian people. And so the military interventions we saw, whether it's the Americans or the Russians or the Turks or the Saudis or the Emiratis or the various private parties who aided and abetted various armed groups in the country, their motivations for involvement had to do with other political considerations, other dynamics, Iran, of course. And so the real tragedy, I think, is that everything in the Middle East has been taken out of the control of the people of the Middle East and into the hands of regional and global power dynamics that have nothing to do with the interests of the people.
Mm-hmm. So where exactly can our audience contact you and find out more about what you're working on?
Well, the best place to look is our website, www.hrw.org. We have all the contact information of our staff, including myself, listed there, and ways you can reach us. You can follow me on Twitter, it's SarahLee1, or you can follow HRW at HRW. We're on Facebook in multiple languages, including Arabic, of course. I really welcome and encourage people to be informed about what's going on and follow our work closely.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And that was it for our interview with Sarah Lee Whitson, the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division. A very interesting conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did, and I learned a lot. So a lot is also coming up on the Bills with Luke Scorzell podcast. Next week, my interview with Jordan A. Brown of the Jordan A. Brown Show will be publishing. On top of that, I have an interview with Brian Nichols of the Brian Nichols Show, and involved a lot in the libertarian movement as well. So that's coming up in a few weeks as well. And then an interview with Tom Brake, a British member of parliament, and a few more interviews in the work. The head from the Stanford College Republicans, the president there, and very exciting stuff. So be sure to go over to theedgeofideas.com/subscribe to get weekly email updates whenever a new episode comes out. And if you're not interested in receiving email notifications when new episodes come out, I just set up a new texting notification system where you can text BILLS to 31996 for notifications when new episodes and offers from Patreon come out. Very excited about that. So be sure to go over and text BILLS to 31996 for text notifications when new episodes come out. And thank you again to our Patreons. Thank you to Zach for his tremendous $30 donation. Greatly appreciated. And he's actually going to submit a few questions to our interview with Brian Nichols. So Patreons get access to do that. Thank you to Mike and Julie and Tiana for their $15 per month donations, as well as all of our $5 and $1 donors. Greatly appreciated. All is a tremendous show of support. So thanks for listening. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and I hope to see you next week. I'm Luke Scorzell, and you're listening to Bills.